This is a Times Online podcast.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to Bugle 80, the sequel, 80.5 Independence Day special. It's a Bugle week off this week, and I am Andy Zaltzman. I defy any man to prove that wrong. And I was in London a week ago when we recorded this, and a week ago in New York. Almighty Zeus alone knows where the f*** he is now, frankly. He could be anywhere.
Yeah,
LA, Saint-Tropez, deep in the forest of Azerbaijan, settling an Oliver family blood feud dating back centuries, or even in the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Who knows? A week is a long time in showbiz. But a week ago in New York was John Oliver.
I think it's actually more likely that I'll be settling a blood feud than be in Saint-Tropez. Don't think I'm going to be in either, but I'll definitely be more likely to be settling that blood feud. Yeah, happy Independence Day. Or is it, Andy? Is it Independence Day? Because I think I've stated before, I do not recognise the American War of Independence. Now, we in Britain, we never properly signed those divorce papers. We just drew a penis and two balls at the bottom of the page where the signature was supposed to go. It's the old penis and two balls trick that we played on most of the empire. That India still thinks it's independent too. Check the contract, South Asia. You got a wang at the bottom where our name should be.
Yep, so this sub-issue of the Bugle is for the week beginning Monday the 6th of July. So it does cover Saturday the 4th of July, you say, Independence Day. But 6th of July, John, that is the 90th anniversary of the first east-west Atlantic airship crossing. The old E-34 airship. What a super little airship she was.
Yeah, lovely airship.
Two million cubic metres of luscious dirigibility. Anyway, 90 years ago today, plonked down in Long Island, would you believe? Yes, you would believe, because I'm telling you, and I'm the voice of truth. But who would have thought now, John, by, you know, just 90 years later, you'd have thought we'd all be travelling in airships by now.
Yeah,
but
I know.
Just as in 1969, you'd have thought by now we'd all be living on the moon. Neither of those things has happened. I guess we've got to ask, though, John, as though we're recording this on the 26th of June. By the time it goes out in 10 days' time, will it still be too soon to crack Michael Jackson jokes?
Yep.
OK.
Yep.
Right.
I wouldn't make that gamble.
OK.
Wouldn't do it, Andy. You know? Be the bigger man here.
All right.
Yeah?
I'm not saying we should do it, John. I'm just advising our listeners.
Okay.
Of course, we wouldn't stoop so low. We're a very noble, satirical podcast here.
Yeah, that's right.
We aim for the stars. We occasionally touch those stars.
Don't do it.
You literally touch those stars.
Yep.
Have you washed your hand yet since the Clooney handshake or not?
No, I told you, I'm not going to.
Do you wear a special glove now?
And that my other hand is ageing so well, just like Clooney.
So this is an Independence Day special, 233 years now since America flipped Britain, the biggest political bird it had ever received in its history. It was cursed, of course, the Declaration of Independence, John. Tommy Jefferson and Johnny Adams, two cats who scribble their autographs on the Declaration of Independence, both died 100% exactly 50 years to the minute later, July the 4th, 1826.
Yep.
That is surely too coincidental to be a coincidence.
They're terrorists. They're terrorists, yep. Andy.
You can kind of
under the rules of the day, they were terrorists. Why are they being celebrated?
You know, I kind of imagine the scene in the American National Care Home for ex-presidents on that fateful day in 1826. Hey, TJ, you're looking a bit peaky today, kid. You ain't looking so hot yourself, little Johnny. Good point. I reckon I'll be dead in a couple of minutes. Me too. Bit annoying, eh, big stuff? Sure is. Yep, if you say so, John Adams. Hey, who'd have thought 50 years ago when we both signed the Declaration of Independence, we'd be sitting here exactly 50 years later, staring eternal oblivion squarely in the chops, about to pop some serious clogs. Well, actually, I would, T-Jeff. Really? Yeah, mate. Yeah, you wouldn't believe this. But that wasn't just the Declaration of Independence. It was a pact with Anubis, the ancient Egyptian god of death. Anubis came up to me, and he said to me, John Adams, I'll cut you a deal. I'll grant you the independence of your nation, but I want your life in return. What now? I said to him. And Anubis barked. Woof, he barked, the dog-headed scoundrel. Woof, mate, I want it now. Anyway, I've always loved to haggle, so I managed to wangle an extra 50 years out of him. For real, said Thomas Jefferson. For real. Jeepers, nice work, J.A. 50 years for free. Yeah, not exactly, T-Jeff. I had to chuck you into the bargain. You what? You little shit! Sorry, mate, it was either me straight away or the pair of us 50 years down the track. I didn't think you'd mind, what with you being 83 by now. That's not the point, shitbag, blasted Jefferson. I might have had something on today. Look, it was either that or no Declaration of Independence. I'll f***ing declare you independent if you're not careful. Well, I think I got us a pretty good deal, to be honest, Tommy. I'm 91, you're 83, it's the 19th century. We both probably lived longer than we would have done otherwise, and we got a Declaration of Independence chucked in for free. Frankly, with that kind of work, it's no wonder the Egyptians went out of business. Hey, Thomas? Sorry, mate, I've died. We're both supposed to be dead. Oh, yeah. Shit. Ugh.
Andy, I think on this day of all days, actually a Michael Jackson joke would have been in better taste.
Some sections of the special supplementary edition are going straight in the bin this week. Free audio vitamin supplements. This noise makes your skin more healthy. This noise stops you getting scurvy. This noise has no discernible effect, but your friend Bridget swears by it and says it helped get her pregnant. And this noise is actively harmful, but has a healthy-sounding name. And also in the bin, free motivational, but achievable slogans, including, failure is not an option, it's a likelihood. To be the best, you've got to wear a vest. The only thing you have to fear is Murgatroyd the vengeful man-eating bear. And a challenge is just an embarrassment waiting to happen.
My favourite slogan, Andy, for one of my favourite podcasts, Tom Sharpling's podcast, his slogan for the year apparently is, some will burn, all will pay.
I think maybe we need a bugle slogan.
Helps get you out of bed in the morning.
There's no I in snooze. How about that?
There's no I in snooze. That would also help you get out of bed in the morning.
If you can't take the heat, get out of the oven.
With a backup slogan, what are you doing in the oven?
Well, let's get on to the extras we've been saving up for this special edition. Firstly, this one. Philosophy news now, and what is a snack?
Good question, Andy. Well, it's puzzled philosophers through the years.
That's right. That's why Aristotle got so fat. Pringles, the famous potato crisp-based crisp, they've lost a legal ruling, John, that they have to pay VAT because they are technically a crisp, not a snack.
Right.
When they'd argue that because of their low potato content, I believe they are, in fact, a snack, not a crisp. But I guess philosophically, John, and I've thought about this quite a lot this week, if a purely hypothetical man eats a packet of crisps while his wife has popped out to the garden for 20 minutes, then goes back into the kitchen 20 minutes later when said wife is back indoors and said, hey, I think we've earned ourselves a packet of crisps each, and she says, I'll skip the crisps, love, I've only just had lunch. He then eats the packet of crisps. Then when she's nipped out to pick someone from nursery, he then ferrets her packet of crisps under his shirt, goes up to his study and eats them. Does that count as three snacks, John, or one snack? One long snack, or perhaps even a subterfuge snack betrayal triple play? Or is it merely proof of the male gender's innate capability for hunter-gathering?
I think you're in a three-snack situation there, aren't you?
Right.
Or, sorry, the person that you're talking about is in a three-snack situation. Right. So maybe if you ever see him or her, then you can pass that information along.
I will.
That's right, the makers of Pringles are now possibly liable for £100 million of back tax and an estimated £20 million a year from now on, because their defence was that they're not a potato snack, as potatoes make up only 42% of their ingredients, which really does beg the question, what the f*** else is in a Pringle? What are they putting in those culinary lab creations? Their defence had been that they were not similar to potato crisps, not only because of this, but also because, and I quote in their defence, their mouth-melt taste, uniform colour and regular shape are not found in nature. No shit, they're not. There is nothing more unnatural in this world than a cheese Pringle, which it is now legally clear has been near neither cheese nor potato. And that, incidentally, should definitely be their new slogan. Never mind once you pop, you can't stop. They should swap over to Pringles. Our taste and shape are not found in nature. It does make some kind of sense, though, Andy, because by pure chance, I did actually have some Pringles for the first time in a long time this week,
really?
And I around 42% enjoyed them.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
It's sounding like it was about to be a bit of product placement.
No, just saying. Oh. I had them this week.
Time now for our Pringle Fact Box. Pringles are named after the former England cricketer Derek Pringle, a tall all-rounder whose career initially promised a lot, rapidly fell short of expectations, and then dragged on for far too long, leaving everyone feeling at the end that they wished they'd put a lid on it much sooner. He was scientifically found to be the sportsman whose career most accurately mirrored the process of eating a packet of Pringles. The unique convex shape of the Pringle is modelled on the shape of the saddle of the donkey Jesus rode in Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. Some Christians believe that eating a packet of Pringles for 40 days and 40 nights consecutively makes you sound like Jesus. Other Christians believe that eating Pringles is an act of heresy tantamount to micturating in a church collection plate. They'll probably end up having a war about it. Special edition flavours of Pringles planned for the 200th anniversary of the Pringle in 2168 include Maria Callas flavour, the Battle of Naseby flavour, that's one for the English Civil War enthusiasts, Hope, Fear, and Strawberry and Rocket Fuel. Pringles also famously come in a tube similar to the shape and size of tennis ball tubes. Due to a mix-up at a snack bar at the 1983 US Open tennis tournament, the women's final was played with barbecue-flavoured Pringles instead of tennis balls. Martina Navratilova beat Chris Evert-Lloyd 6-1-6-3. Of course, Navratilova, John, had grown up in ancient communist Czechoslovakia, where tennis balls were banned, learning to play the game with any available snack, from crisps to nuts via popcorn and squirrel jerky. Chris Evert-Lloyd, by contrast, was from Florida, where tennis balls grow naturally on trees, showing she'd never played tennis with snacks and therefore was comprehensively outplayed before later divorcing her tennis-playing husband, John Lloyd, the least bad British tennis player of his era, who would advise her from the stand that her usual baseline game would not work due to the different aerodynamic qualities of the Pringle. She never forgave John Lloyd and has since married a skier and a golfer just to make her point.
Well, there was a bit that we deemed not good enough to get into a previous actual bugle, Andy.
Yep.
I think we can probably see why. You know, it wasn't without merit, but you know, didn't quite make the cut.
I think it just shows what stratospheric standards we've set with the rest of the stuff,
mate. Oh, sure. I mean, I'm not saying it was bad. I'm just saying it's like Tiger Woods on a bad round.
You just don't come here and slag off the bugle while I'm listening, all right, mate?
No, I'm not slagging off. I'm saying Tiger Woods on a bad round. You know, it wasn't the best he can play. He's still the greatest golfer who ever lived. Here's another Tiger Woods shooting only 11 under par.
New Zealand news now. Quick explanation for our American listeners. New Zealand is a nation in the South Pacific whose interests include rugby and... No, it's gone. Anyway, uncharacteristically, New Zealand has in fact been a Newsie land this week. Thanks very much. As it has been discovered that its two main islands are forgeries. In a way, the names of the two islands, imaginative and accurately named, North Island and South Island, best to keep it simple when you're naming islands. I mean, let's look at Greenland, for example, a confusing misnomer, given that it's covered from Bonster Clod in ice, meaning that you could easily sail or swim right past it, thinking, no, it can't be that. Or Baffin Island, where, ironically, it is now illegal to baff anything. Anyway, the North...
What did you just say, Andy? Repeat that.
I said, in Baffin Island, it's now illegal to baff anything.
And what are you implying the word baff means there?
I don't know, John. All I know is that you can't do it on Baffin Island, and that seems wrong. The North and South Islands of New Zealand, it transpired, were never officially named. So for the last 200 years, New Zealanders have been living somewhere that technically does not exist. Now it looks to be taking the obvious option, which is to keep the names, make them official, and use them alongside the old indigenous Maori names for the islands, which include Te Ika'a Maui, which translated means Maui's fish, and Te Waka'a Aoraki, meaning Aoraki's canoe. Both of these, of course, sound like philosophical problems. According to the theory of Aoraki's canoe, if a canoeist falls out of his canoe whilst canoeing on a rapid, and the canoe disappears downriver, leaving the man clinging onto a tree stump thinking of his mother, is he still a canoeist, and is the canoe still a canoe? Think about that. So looking at the names, John, though, it does give you a bit of an insight into the workings of the British Empire. That we pitched up there and said, right, what are these places called? The Fish of Maui and the Canoe of Aoraki. That's a bit imaginative. Right, we'll soon shoot that out of them. Bang, let's call you the North. Bang, let's call you South. Let's clear that up. Come on, Britain. It does also raise the question of... what other places have not been officially named? There is a theory that Canada is in fact owned and therefore named by Lewin and Marjorie Boomshanker of Coventry, England, the descendants of the 17th century British explorer Herodotus Boomshanker, who arrived on the coast of Labrador in 1624 and found himself confronted by a really sweet litter of puppies and said, "Ah, I'm having this place, let's start marking it out. 5 pints of water, please." Now, admittedly, that is a theory that has only recently been formulated by a London-based lapsed Jewish amateur historian, but it's a theory nonetheless. And is it any less plausible than the real story of Canada, John? I've no idea.
I'm just looking up to see whether anyone has actually had the surname Boomshanker. Because if not, I'm tempted to become the first. Oh, hold on.
Is there a
Boomshanker? In the Urban Dictionary, it says Boomshanker means the seed... Did you notice?
I didn't know.
The seed of your loin be fruitful in the belly of your woman. And there's a band called Boom Shanker.
Is there?
Yeah. I think I'm just going to play one of their songs now.
There's also a font called Boom Shanker.
Listen to that. That's disappointing. That's not elevator music. Can you hear that?
I can hear that, John.
I don't think that's the kind of music that the band Boom Shanker employs. I'm always being fashion forward, Andy.
Yeah, mate. Yep.
Fashion way, way forward. And, you know, fashion
always, overbalancing into a dick.
It's always been important to me. You know how much I love clothes.
You wear clothes.
I wear them. I love the way they protect my wang from direct contact with the sun. I guess that's the thing I love most about clothes, but it's not just that. I'm also interested in all areas of fashion, as this next offcut will demonstrate.
Bugle feature section now, and fashion. That's what we're all about, John.
What's hot, what's not, Andy?
That's right.
That's what I'm about. Make a choice. There's no grey area. You're either hot or not.
So you've been in GQ, haven't you?
Not yet, but I will be. Not yet. You'll know when it happens. You'll feel a disturbance in the force.
You're a fashion icon.
That's also not true. Actually, do you know what? I've not been in it yet, and I would still not be surprised if either I'm taken out of it or I'm pixelated.
Later on, an in-depth look at how to look like a prick, but still make it clear you spent an incredible amount of money to do so. We tell you whether something is disgusting and cool or just disgusting. Also, how to look trendy and bulletproof. Plus, a special section on fashion for monks and nuns, the coolest cassocks, the hottest habits, the wowiest wimples, and the scorchingest scapulars. And we've all been hit by the credit crunch, so is it still possible to look $1 million whilst only spending $500,000? But I think time, John, now to look at summer fashion. And there was an article I saw on a website whilst researching the fashion section.
Yeah.
It's had the headline, How to Dress for Summer. And it's quite hard to read a headline like that without wondering why on earth the article is longer than the simple words, put some clothes on, then take some off again if you're too hot. But I think it's time that we should look at what the fashion-conscious bugler should be seen to be wearing this June, July, August fashion trimester to avoid being teased and humiliated by work colleagues for not being hip. Well, I guess for the lady bugler, John, I'd have to advise a funky look for summer 2009, maybe a halter-head scalpless hat, a choker made of alternating diamonds and sausages, a basque, that's a real basque, a proudly independent Iberian from the Bilbao area... Just wrap round the waist.
That's some adventurous underwear.
That's right.
What are you doing?
I'm not Spanish.
Untie me. Untie me. I'm not Spanish. Stop calling me Spanish. Untie me. Get me away from your boobies. I'm not Spanish. Stop calling me Spanish. That's the worst thing you could call me.
So I'd go with that, and then maybe a full-length brawl ground and some socks. You've got to have some socks these days. Whilst for the gentleman bugler, I'd go with an on-the-shoulder tarpaulin and tie look, with camouflage underpants, just in case you get lost in the jungle and don't want anyone to see your personals, and 360-degree trousers. All the way around, guys. All the way. And in makeup, well, John, here in Britain, this summer's makeup is woad. It's back... It's back after all this time. It's what we used to paint ourselves blue with whenever the Romans invaded to try and make Britain look colder and less desirable for conquest. And that is the colour we're all going for. It's quite an anti-European kind of makeup, I would say. But I think now it's time, John, to talk about the future of the shoe, John. Because for me, the shoe of the future, it's got to be the slipper. I think the brogue has very much had its day, and although the welly boot has its place... As the old saying goes, if you step out of bed in the morning and put your welly boots on straight away, your life's gone badly wrong, or you're a farmer. So that just leaves the slipper. And it's such a versatile shoe, John, unless you want to do anything vigorous or outdoors. But if for your everyday indoor shoe, you'd have to be a c*** to wear anything else. Did you see Jake Gyllenhaal at the Oscars this year wearing a pair of brogues with live Babri Cobras as the laces?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was bold and it was brave, but he can carry them off, Andy.
Yeah. Really cool, I thought. Really cool. Yeah. But, well, let's put it this way. I doubt Reese Witherspoon will ever play footsie under the table with him again. Get well soon, Reese.
Right, Andy. The only thing I need to know is how you know that those two are seeing each other.
Well, there's an interesting story behind that, John.
Yeah?
Because, well, I thought of a movie actor for that obvious lie. And,
you thought...
Gyllenhaal. Yep. And then I thought of a Hollywood actress, and I just thought Witherspoon.
No, no, you didn't. I only
know about three. And then I thought, oh, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll check whether or not Gyllenhaal actually has a girlfriend. So I went on Wikipedia, where it was, which just suggests to me this one is meant to be. Stick together, guys.
I'm glad you wish them the best.
Some new shoe technology news. The shoe manufacturer Hobswick have introduced the TripSafe shoe. It's a shoe with a distance sensor on the front to warn the wearer when they are within 10 centimetres of a raised paving slab. And also the new Convenio Clog. It's a retractable wooden shoe that enables you to change your socks without taking your shoes off. So these really are great times for the 21st century shoe. In other shoe news, the shoe manufacturer Podicraft has apologised to consumers after there were complaints that their squiggly-toes children's range of footwear on certain rubberised floor surfaces make squeaking noises that sounded like the words Sieg Heil. It was an honest mistake caused by us using a different material on the sole of the shoe that we have not fully tested for potential fascist-sounding squeaks, said company spokesman Brenda Goering, before driving off very quickly in a darkened car. Now that's all for Bugle Fashion. Look smart, buglers! Well, we don't hear quite so much about the financial meltdown as we used to, which might explain why this bit didn't make the cut when we first recorded it.
American news now. Regulators, mount up! President Obama...
What, mate?
Oh, it's going to become clear, and you're not going to like it. President Obama released a brand new plan for banking regulation this week to prevent us from getting into the kind of financial shitstorm that we seem to have self-brewed recently. And I really think, here it comes, Andy, that Warren G and Nate Dogg said this best in their song Regulate. 16 in the clip and one in the hole. Nate Dogg's about to make somebody's turn cold. Now they drop it and yell in, it's a tad bit late. Nate Dogg and Warren G had to regulate. I don't think I can say it better than that, Andy. A dense allegory of a world of uncontrolled investment bankers running wild. Nate Dogg is about to make some bodies turn cold. Clearly that means that Nate Dogg is about to tell someone the gravity of the situation the world's economy finds itself in. And that is indeed enough to turn anyone's body cold.
Nate Dogg?
Nate Dogg.
Right,
Nate Dogg.
Is he in relation
Nate
of Snoop or not?
I think it is.
Is it a brother?
I think it's his nephew.
Nephew.
He's definitely a member of the Dogg Pound.
Right.
Anyway. Anyway, moving on. Now they're dropping and yelling, it's a tad bit late. Surprising use of tad from a rapper, but it's well put. It is indeed a tad bit late for the banks to be dropping and yelling at the conditions being put on the bailout. Nate Dogg and Warren G got to regulate. It is time for Nate Dogg, Warren G, or indeed any major Federal Reserve to step in and get control of this unwieldy economic system.
Do you think Warren G is really fully qualified to regulate the American financial system?
Well, I mean, that is an argument you can make, Andy, but you could argue, no, was anyone better qualified than him who was in charge of regulating the banks over the last 10 years? I think when you have the amounts of AAA bonds issued, I think you could argue that Warren G wouldn't have done a worse job.
Do you know why Warren G was so called?
No, Andy. Hold on. I'll bite. Why was Warren G so called?
It was called because he was born whilst his parents were on a rabbit hunting expedition and his father had uncovered the biggest known family of rabbits all in the same underground house.
You done?
Yeah, I think I'm done there, mate. How do you know that song, John?
I don't know. It goes in, Andy.
You went to Cambridge, John. You're not supposed to know that kind of shit.
No, I probably only heard it a few times, but it went in.
Have you taken a blow to the head since you went to America?
Pretty much. It's contagious. Any song that begins with a man screaming, "Regulators, mount up," it makes you think, oh, if I had a horse, I'd do that. The overhaul, Andy, will require big banks to put much more money aside against future losses to curb excessive risk-taking.
Is this still part of the song?
No. All right. this is the break.
Talky bit.
Yeah, that's it. Not a talky bit. You can't call it a talky bit. Obama said that the complex financial instruments were meant to spread risk, but instead concentrated it. It was easy money, he said, but these schemes were built on a pile of sand. But it's not even sand, Andy. They weren't built on a pile of sand. They were often built on a pile of shit.
As any qualified architect will tell you, that's a very dangerous place to be.
Very dangerous. Very dangerous.
That's why Richard Rogers took so long to get to the top. He was just obsessed with building stuff on piles of shit. We've had some fantastic kind of regulation news over here as well, John. The governor of the Bank of England, he's called for greater powers for the bank to enable it to carry out its new role of promoting financial stability. Mervyn King, the governor, said that the bank could no longer act, quotes, like a church whose congregation ignores its sermons. And I guess he could have gone on there and said, and whose congregation not only ignores its sermons, but also only ever bothers turning up when it's done something appallingly wrong and desperately wants to beg for forgiveness before it ends up in hell, and whose entire philosophical basis is based on outdated dogma and superstition, and whose priests interfere with, I think I've made my point.
Very good.
Well, there seems no point really shilly-shallying around now. Here's another bit. Other news now, and, well, the weather has been in trouble here in Britain, John, for being too good. Various tourist resorts in Britain, if such a term is not wildly over-promotional, have blamed weather forecasts for putting people off going to those places on the bank holiday weekend. The weather forecasts were apparently unduly pessimistic and put people off from going. Bournemouth, on the south coast, claimed it was 25,000 tourists down due to an adverse weather forecast when it was actually a very sunny day. And this, John, is a classic case of shooting the messenger, really. I think it seems to me rather like a bed and breakfast owner in Helmand province complaining that people aren't coming on holiday to his area anymore because of newsreaders. It just doesn't seem fair. And Bournemouth also should just stop blaming others and focus on its many, many saleable assets as a tourist destination, which include it's nicer than Derby, it's got a better beach than St Moritz, and you're less likely to be eaten by a lion than in Africa. Now, when sold in those terms, why wouldn't you want to go to Bournemouth? Enjoy that. You enjoyed it, didn't you? Ah, don't deny it. Have another one. There you go. Treat yourselves. And in other news, rooks are apparently the cleverest animals in the world. They can make tools with beaks, according to scientific research. Rooks can make tools with their beaks. These include making little wire hooks, modifying sticks for prodding, and also making a rudimentary cordless power drill. This scientific research, John, just shows the dangers of leaving a scientist unattended for more than a week. They will come up with something that gets in the paper. What are you doing for Independence Day? What will you be doing for Independence Day?
Well, putting on my red coat, taking out my musket, and just pick off as many people as I can.
Good old tradition, eh?
Means different things to different people.
Yeah. Well, to our American listeners, do enjoy Independence Day. You're welcome to it from a British perspective, which at the end of the day has been proven by history to be the correct perspective. Looking at America struggling with $11 trillion debt, we're well shot of it, mate. America was a nice hobby at the time, but a bit too expensive. I see America very much like my brother's old Mazda MX-5 sports car. Bit of fun, but there's always going to be time to move on eventually. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with a full bugle next week.
Cheerio.
Bye-bye.
This is a Times Online podcast. For more podcasts, go to timesonline.co.uk/podcasts.